The place to be is living free. Living free in Tennessee.
Welcome to the Living Free podcast, where we talk about building a life without limits. Today is Tuesday, April 29th, 2025. And I've got a great interview ahead with Joel Salatin, the lunatic farmer from Polyface Farms. But before we hop into that, I did want to talk about our featured event of today's show. And I thought it was more than fitting to choose something that's going on at Polyface in May. So we're going to feature the Exit and Build Land Summit 5, which is coming up right there. You can meet Joel Salatin in person. Hopefully Daniel will be there too. Will he be there too, Joel?
Yeah, he'll be here.
Yeah, I think I saw him on the agenda. So let me just tell you guys, having been to Polyface, you've heard about it. You've read about it. If you haven't been there, you haven't seen it. And there is a major difference between hearing about it, seeing some video there, and seeing the systems that they've put in place. I was particularly excited to see the series of ponds that you've put together from the spring. But anyway, Exit and Build Land Summit is going to be there. I think it's May 23rd and 24th. Tickets are still available. And it is the Land Summit 5 on Polyface Farms. I will have a link in the show notes for y'all if you want to go to that. I also want to thank two sponsors of today's show. The first sponsor is Above Phone. If you want to interact with electronic devices and not share all of your information with everybody who can purchase it, Above Phone has a privacy-oriented device, and it works out of the box. You basically take it out of the box, pop your SIM card in there, turn it on, enter your PIN, and it just works. They also include about an hour of consulting with it as you ask, like, how do I set this up so I can access, you know, that Facebook, for example, which totally doesn't violate your privacy at all, but maybe they do a little bit. You can set up a little Facebook room in the phone that keeps it separate from other parts of the phone so that when you choose to interact, you're choosing to trade privacy for social interaction, but it's not also accessing, you know, your meal plans on your notes app or anything else you might not want to share. So check them out at abovephone.com. Our second sponsor, of course, is Huller Roast Coffee. We roast everything to order here at Huller Roast Coffee. And we are pretty careful about sourcing our beans from farms that are certified organic or do their best to adhere to organic growing practices. And they are single source direct from farm purchases through an importer. So we are trusting the importer. Check them out at hollerroast.com. And we will be serving that coffee on Polyface in 2.5 weeks at the Exit and Build Land Summit. With that, I want to say, Joel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nicole. It's always a delight to spend any time I can with you.
Well, you know, it's funny. I have a personal question after the first question for you, but let's start with the first question, which is, why do you think you were the kind of person that is willing to stand up against the systems and the programming to be freedom oriented?
So I have this rich legacy of maverickness in my family. My grandfather, my dad's dad, was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine when it came out in 1945, something like that. And my dad, after flying in the Navy in World War II, he had a dream of going to a developing country. This was, a lot of people don't realize that the late 1940s and early 1950s were a time of tremendous, you know, socialism and communism influx in the country. I mean, this is why Ayn Rand wrote Atlas Shrugged during that time, was to thwart that campus, you know, stuff that was going on. Anyway, Dad saw the rot already in America. Said, "Hey, I want to go to a place where it's really, you know, free and open." So he thought, you know, South America would be good. So he got on with Texas Oil Company as a bilingual accountant in Venezuela, and then married Mom. And within seven years, was able to save enough to buy a thousand acre farm there, property there in the uplands of Venezuela, and started raising chickens. And and was doing it, you know, clean. They were much cleaner than the indigenous birds that ran in, you know, squat pots and open sewers and things like that through the villages, and quickly cornered the market on the local chicken market. You know how those Latin American countries, you go down to your stall, you know, and you sell, and people come, and actually middlemen come and buy from you, and then they have their route down through the city, you know, and they hawk it through the city. And so, of course, you know, our chickens were so clean that the local yokels, they didn't ask how to get theirs that clean. They accused us of witchcraft and you know, voodooism. And so in 1959, when there was a junta of Pérez Jiménez was in power, and there was a junta against him. And when you have that kind of lawlessness, you know, a junta, it allows scores to be settled that wouldn't be settled otherwise. And so that gave license for the locals to kind of put the hurtings on this gringo. And so we fled the back doors. The machine guns came in the front door, lost everything. Dad was 39. All of his life's, you know, savings and equity and dream. He was there for 12 years. Loved the people, loved the culture, loved. I mean, how can you not love something? You grow bananas and papayas and pineapples in your backyard. And so, you know, so we stayed for another 8 or 9 months trying to get protection, but we couldn't. So we left and came back to the U.S. Meanwhile, we're watching the national press say the junta, you know, the government is protecting American interests and blah, 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 and all this. All a lie, completely a lie. And of course, you know, the U.S. was giving the corrupt government their foreign aid, and like we do still. And so anyway, Dad was very, very libertarian oriented. And so I grew up in a home that that we subscribed to FEE, you know, a Foundation for Economic Freedom, and libertarian type things, and just, you know, grew up that way. Dad wrote so many letters to the editor that the local newspaper instituted a one letter a month policy. So he had a couple friends that said, well, we'll sign the letters if you write them. And so he just kept cranking out letters with other signatures on them, you know, into the newspaper. So, you know, one of the greatest blessings of my life was growing up in this family that embraced different. You know, we just really didn't care about what, you know, what the norm was or what other people were doing. And so grew up with that wonderful, you know, libertarian bent, so that then when I started the farming and started getting pushback from government regulations, and, you know, my first business plan was to milk 10 cows by hand and sell the milk to the neighbors, and that was illegal. I've never gotten over that, the fact that the government kept me off the farm because what I wanted to grow and sell, you know, was illegal. So that just made me double down, and so we've just taken that kind of libertarian streak. But we've had a lot of practical, you know, practical implications of it because we've been on the fringes of the food movement, and that exercises your, you know, your philosophy when you actually have practical, you know, visceral, whatever, interaction with your philosophy.
So that's fascinating that you had a pretty early on in your life, a very, what would be a traumatic experience. That then led to hard work to build, you know, to set the foundation for what you've then taken over and built further. And we're in an environment with parents who were libertarian, but they did not raise you and flip you. They didn't push it on you. It seems like they just provided a nurturing environment where you embraced it yourself.
Yeah, we did. And boy, the stack of around our table, there was always discussion about, you know, local policy issues. For example, I remember in the late 60s when our county started talking about bringing in zoning, land zoning. And Dad just wrote prolifically letters to the editor, you know, that all this is going to do, it's just going to create another agency that all they do is give out political concessions to people for exemptions to the zoning regulations. And that's exactly what's happened. You know, if you're not on the inside, you don't get any concessions. And so, you know, we just grew up kind of, you know, outside the system. And I tasted that kind of freedom, Nicole. A lot of people don't realize when I was about 14, my chickens were expanding. I had a garden. We were milking a couple Guernsey cows. We always had, you know, cottage cheese and milk and yogurt and stuff. And so Dad was an accountant, and he understood from an economic standpoint, a small farm could not compete at the wholesale commodity level because the margins are too low. You can't produce enough volume at scale, you know, when you're small. So we had to become the middleman. We had to become not only the producer, but we had to become the processor, the marketer, and the distributor, you know, and get all those forms of income in that chain of custody. Well, as soon as you do that, and you start, you know, in our modern industrial system, bringing the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker back to the village, back to the farm setting, you run afoul of all sorts of government regulations. From, you know, I remember once I saw a little ad in the paper. They're going to have a public hearing to prohibit on farm sawmills, and we didn't have one yet. But we were using I had dreams of having a bandsaw mill that we could mill our own lumber, our own logs. We have a lot of woods here, a lot of forest. And so I went down to the hearing. I'll never forget. I went down to the hearing, and apparently some guy who had a sawmill in the county part time, he'd gotten a big order from somebody. You know, it was a bit of a windfall for him, and so he was running that thing, you know. Worked in town. He just was a part timer, but he had this nice big order he was trying to fill. And somebody moved in from who knows, New Jersey, New York, somewhere, and complained to the county about the noise. This guy's running at 11 o'clock at night. You know, I want to go to sleep. And so the county decided to amend their ordinance that, you know, and prohibit sawmills in agricultural zones. Well, our farm is zoned agricultural. So I go down there and I said, wait a minute, guys. I said, this would keep me from being able to cut a tree on my own place, mill the log for my own use. And they said, oh yeah, you're right. We didn't think about that. And on the spot, they just amended it and put an exemption in for milling your own, you know, lumber on your own place. And in other words, people don't realize how close you can come to losing these freedoms. I was the only member of the public down there. There wasn't another single person. There was nobody from the press. You had these, you know, five unelected officials appointed by the board that are going to determine this resource, you know, resource policy and market capacity for the entire county, just basically on one complaint and a whim. And this is how fast, this is how tenuous our freedoms are, that sort of thing. I have been able to punch through another part of the ordinance, though, that so I can mill a log, I can turn it into lumber, but I can't legally make a chair and sell it because that is manufacturing, and manufacturing is prohibited in an agricultural zone. So, you know, we still don't have the freedom to do that. But at least I protected us, our ability to at least mill a log.
That it seems crazy to me that if you're going to look at what farms do and what comes off of a farm, that the minute you go from milling to making it into furniture, which is then a beautiful polyface produced chair, that suddenly is no longer agricultural just because you finished it all the way.
Yeah, well, see, and that's, Nicole, that's part of the whole, you know, regulatory, our industrial regulatory process is a very segregated process. It is not integrated. It is not holistic. It is not, there's nothing natural about it. It's a very, you know, partisan bifurcated system. I mean, isn't it interesting that RFK Jr., who's now the, you know, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, HHS, that is an entirely different department agency than food and farming, which is over at USDA. You know, you would think that health would have something to do with food and farming, but it doesn't. And so you know, these agencies they thrive. They thrive on splitting everything apart, on segregating everything. And that's exactly the way we've done now. We've determined that a farm is for raw production. You know, that's what an agriculture system does, is it's raw production. And so anything else, again, bringing the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker back to the farm is considered, you know, manufacturing. What better place to make a chair than near where the trees grow? I mean, you know, that just
nonsense.
Yeah.
We need to ship that somewhere else.
Yeah. Another thing that's prohibited in agricultural zone is a slaughterhouse. You know, well, what better place to butcher animals than near where they grow? You know, why do you have to put everything on a trailer, send it 40 miles up the interstate, you know, so you can bring it home so you can sell it to a neighbor? I mean, none of this makes sense. It breaks all these natural symbiotic and synergistic relationships. It breaks them apart and segregates them. And we, you know, and that's just, you know, that's just the way our system is now set up.
Yeah, you can see from an efficiency standpoint how a very large butcher thought, I know, if I centrally locate in the city and all the farmers bring it to me, I can do this step. But from a quality of food standpoint, the animal meandering into being slaughtered without going on a car ride first, which I don't know if you guys know this, but in general, I know my sheep do not love going in the trailer places because they find that alarming, because what they usually do is hang out in the grass, eating grass and chewing their cud. So you've got a stressed animal at that point. Even if you did everything right, I think it impacts the flavor if they're not as calm. So having that capacity right there and having it integrated allows you to do that. And then if you are also looking at your farm holistically, where you can then compost the things you don't need to use and use that for fertility, it all feeds itself.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, we would love to bring back, you know, all the offal, the guts, you know, from our cattle and things that we have slaughtered. But, you know, you're going to love this one, Nicole. So you can put those, we're going to take 10 steers, put them on a trailer and take them down to the slaughterhouse. Okay. So we put them on the trailer, we take them down to the slaughterhouse. If we now wait there while they butcher them and put their, you know, a steer has a lot of guts. I mean, you know, the intestines and paunch and all that. So it almost fills a 55-gallon drum, each one. All right. So we take our animals down there. We get them butchered and hung. The carcasses are hung. We've got now 10 barrels of guts. If we put those 10 barrels on the same trailer that we carried the steers down to the slaughterhouse in, that is now a hazardous substance and requires a special license to put it on the public road.
That's insane.
It is insane. So the live animal in the trailer is perfectly benign, nothing, no permit, nothing required at all. But as soon as you take the guts from that animal, put it in a barrel into the same trailer, now you can't drive on the same road without a bunch of special licenses and compliance papers. I mean,
but wait, if they put the guts in the bag and freeze them, can you drive with the bag?
Huh. Now that's an interesting. If it's frozen, I haven't seen the regs stipulate whether it's fresh or frozen. That's a fascinating idea. If a frozen product would, of course, but that would take a lot of energy to freeze. Even if that were like a loophole you could go through, boy, the cost of freezing the guts. I mean, talk about an unnecessary cost. And suddenly you've got all this cost. I mean, so yeah, like you said, you want to keep all this stuff, as near and close as you can. And not, you know, run all over the countryside with it. So, you know, these are, that's why I have a real trouble with the people that want government intrusion in everything. And often those are, you know, those are also environmentalists.
Our derogatory name for that are Karens.
and Karens.
That's what people just basically call them, Karens. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So the problem is that they want to solve everything with regulation rather than solving things with freedom. I mean, I just, here's a perfect example. I just got a letter from, I get asked to sign on to stuff, you know, to endorse it, and then, you know, it'll have more clout or whatever. And, there's an effort trying to ban ractopamine in hogs. It's an ionophore growth, you know, substance. And, yeah, it's a terrible thing. And what, 95% of the hogs in the U.S. it's put in their feed, ractopamine. And so, you know, I'm sitting here looking at this. They want me to sign on to, you know, to do a letter to Secretary Rollins and RFK Jr. to ban this, this feed additive for hogs. Well, my question is, I wonder if you people would be as interested in signing on to my idea of a food emancipation proclamation that would allow consenting adults exercising freedom of choice. And I know I'm using, you know, powerful language, but we need powerful language. Consenting adults using freedom of choice to choose, you know, what I'm getting the fuel for my microbiome, to allow neighbor to neighbor food transactions without a bureaucrat between the transaction. Neighbor to neighbor. You know, in other words, we live next door. You want to come onto my farm, ask around, look around, and you say, hey, I'd like to get some sausage from that pig you just butchered. I should be able to sell you that sausage without a bureaucrat and $500,000 or $1 million facility, you know, wrapping around that transaction and all the licenses and regulations. And the problem is that as soon as you think your answer to stuff is a regulatory answer, you allow yourself to get co-opted into that system. You know, so I wrote them back and I said, you know, hey, I'll sign this if you'll sign mine to have a food emancipation proclamation and free up so that neighbors can raise more pigs and butcher them and sell them to their neighbors. Then the stranglehold of the big industrial food complex that feeds ractopamine won't exist as big as it is, because there'll be competition in the marketplace. You know, so there are lots of ways to deal with these things that we don't like. And I suggest that in general, 95% of the time, the best way to deal with it is through liberty and not through additional regulatory intervention.
Yeah, the challenge with regulatory intervention is that it sets a foundation for abuse of that practice, right? You know, we see it with executive orders, where every president seems to successively use more executive order and try to get more power into that branch. And, you know, the other side screams while they're doing it, and then the minute they get their guy in, they're doing the same thing. But what you were talking about relates to Pack Rat here has a question is, do you think there will be a federal level acknowledgement of the right for local producers to sell packaged meats that are not USDA, like the Prime Act sort of approach?
As much pushback as Congressman Massey has gotten just on something as seemingly benign as the Prime Act, no, I don't think this kind of freedom would happen for a very, very long time. And that's why I'm pushing for the that's my term, food emancipation proclamation. I mean, Nicole, in full transparency to you, I feel like what could be more Trumpian than a food emancipation proclamation? Okay, America, we're going to unshackle the food system, and we're going to stop the enslavement of the food system to Monsanto and Tyson, and we're going to have a food emancipation proclamation. I mean, you think of all the executive orders he signed. I mean, to actually have one that gives people freedom would be pretty cool. I'm really pushing this because I think at some level, we've got to offer food transactions that aren't regulated at some level. you know, everything else, let's do a little bit of the philosophy here on everything else, like hazardous substances, like methamphetamine, fentanyl, prescription drugs. And of course I'm for taking all the regulations off of them too, but just for sake of discussion right now in our country, these are all, you know, hazardous substances and the prohibitions regarding them are fairly across the board. In other words, you can't sell it. You can't buy it. You can't use it. You can't give it to your kids. You can't even own it, you know, without licensing. But food is completely different. In food, you can give it away. You can give raw milk away. You can, you know, you can give your sausage away, your homemade bologna or homemade, you know, charcuterie or chicken pot pie. You can give it away. You can feed it to your children. You can have it. You can even buy it. The only prohibition on is you can't sell it. So there's only one side of the equation, of the multiple equations, that the prohibition is on. So clearly this is not about unsafe food. It's not about ensuring safe food. It's not about hazardous food. It is about controlling the access to the market. Otherwise, if it truly was hazardous, if it truly was hazardous to, you know, to butcher a pig and make sausage and sell it to a neighbor, the prohibition would be on buying, using, eating, feeding it to your children. You know, it would be consistent across the board, but it's not. And that's why this whole thing is a charade.
Yeah, Dave says, sounds like food cottage laws. I've been in Maine where that's, I think, the most free food state in the country.
Yes, it is.
And what has happened as a result of them getting out of the way of at least people locally in the state being able to do whatever they want is they have a whole bunch of pop-up farm-to-table dinners, and you can go to the local store and get raw milk straight out of the fridge, and all of these really cool locally raised vegetable varieties that we don't have down here in Tennessee because they wouldn't do well. And it's created a thriving food economy, but it's also connecting people with better nutrients, nutritional food, and better food security when things break down in the commercial system, because your option at that point is, you know, go get it from somewhere else far away, or you already have people growing it here or producing things you can have. So, you know, you're in a better place if, you know, I don't know, like, there are shutdowns at the ports due to illnesses, and all of a sudden the shelves are bare of lettuce because we couldn't possibly grow lettuce here and put it in the grocery store. We need to bring it in from California, and we can't get it here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, does anybody really think that in the spring of 2020, when COVID was the big thing, and the store shelves went empty, that we would have had as big a hiccup in the food system if instead of the U.S. being supplied by about, you know, 3,000 mega processing facilities, if instead we'd have been supplied by 300,000 neighborhood, you know, small scale, you know, cannery processing, abattoir, you know, kind of facilities. And it's a rhetorical question. Of course, there wouldn't have been as big a hiccup if the funnel had been broader and had been spread out and the stability, security, and safety of food had been democratized across the landscape much better. Of course, we would have weathered that, you know, far better. Do you know, I actually don't know this and have tried to find out. I don't know that Maine allows home slaughtered beef to be sold to a neighbor yet. I'm not sure that that's the case. I do know that there's a lot of pushback on the inspectors up there, who nitpick at stuff. And so Maine, bless their hearts, they have, you know, in the South, anybody can get by with anything. You say, bless your heart. In Maine, they've kind of created this rebel culture for where the businesses are simply, you know, thumbing their nose at some of the inspectors, and it's so big that, you know, they, the state is maybe not winning, but at least they're pulling up even, if you will, and, to the feds. And that's exciting. But I don't think that it's gone to the meat yet. You know, where you could actually slaughter a pig in your backyard and sell sausage to a neighbor. I'm not sure it's gone to that point, but I know that in the slaughterhouses, they've really pushed back on the nitpickiness of the inspectors.
I don't know the answer to that question, but we can find that out. But I would expect if we had gotten to that point, we'd both know about it.
Yeah, I would think so.
Because that is next level. I mean, like here we can do up to 3,000 chickens a year, but I can't slaughter my sheep and sell you the sheep meat.
Yeah.
And I can sell you the sheep and teach you how to slaughter the sheep.
Yeah. 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 In Virginia, we can do 20,000 chickens.
Yeah.
That's the federal, and that's in about, I don't know, 28 states, but 22 states have been more restrictive, and Tennessee is perhaps one of them. But you know, that begs the question. So 3,000 chickens without inspection you can do as a producer grower, sell it to an end user. You can't sell it to Walmart or Costco, but you can sell it to an end user, which would be a family or restaurant. You can sell it to Walmart's delicatessen, you know, where it's going to be cooked and come out as an end user. An end user is where it's sold and nothing else happens to it till it's consumed. That's an end user. And so, you know, why does suddenly the 3,000 and first chicken, why does that one become hazardous when the 3,000th one wasn't? And furthermore, what is more hazardous about one lamb that weighs 70 pounds than 3,000 chickens that weigh 15,000 pounds? You know, again, none of this makes sense, and none of it has science behind it. It's all a political issue. And people say, well, you know, it's those big bad industrial companies. You know, they've come up with this. No. It's been the consumer advocacy people, the Ralph Naderites, the Henny Penny, the scaredy cats. Oh, I'm scared to death of Tyson, so we need regulations. Now, for sure, Tyson sits at the table and they protect their interests. That is for sure. But in general, the regulatory climate we have has not been industry pushed. It's been consumer pushed by people who feel completely disempowered and unable to do sleuthing vetting or band together to do their own, you know, collaborative sleuthing and vetting. And so the default position is look for the government for an answer. Look, you could get together a underwriter's laboratory, you know, that does extension cords could easily do chickens. AAA that does automobiles could easily check, pig sausage. I mean, all this can be done privately. The most disempowering thought in any culture is to think that the only solution to something is a government intervention. That's the most disempowering thing you can do in a culture. There are so many things that we can do at the private level, at the independent level, that don't require government action. I mean, from education to retirement, we could go down a long list, a big long list. But unfortunately, we have now bred a culture to where, when there's a problem, the average person, their first reaction to a problem is a government solution, and that is un-American and tragic, and leads to a bad place.
Well, and it's all about mindset, right? With the reason we talk a lot about, like, why is Joel freedom oriented? Why is Nicole freedom oriented? How did that happen? How did you stand up to the programming? Is that when you or I say, I know, like, y'all ship your meat all over the country. On like you figured out how to do that in an efficient way, and in a way that keeps the meat fresh, because you certainly don't want your customers getting a polyface chicken and it's rotten or dangerous. But the minute you say you're doing that, if you aren't quote unquote properly permitted and all of these other things, and you accept money for it, it is now dangerous. And if you tell somebody you're doing that, they tell you all the reasons you can't. You know, I have a freeze dryer and I was like, you know, I could rent access to this and people could take their surplus when I'm not using it and freeze dry. And the food Nazis came out and were telling me how it was dangerous and going to kill somebody to let them use my machine. But apparently if they had their own machine at home, that would not be dangerous and killing them. But my machine for $20 a day or whatever I decide to choose for it, that is going to kill them.
That's a great example, Nicole, of the basic prejudice in our culture that somehow the bureaucracy is honest and business is dishonest. I mean, there's this kind of overriding assumption that bureaucrats and the bureaucracy and the government is honest because they don't have a profit motive, and businesses are dishonest because they have a profit motive. No, actually, businesses are certainly no more dishonest, and I would argue maybe in general more honest than government entities, because they do have a profit motive and they want to keep their customers and they want to make people happy and they don't want to hurt people and kill people. The only businesses that are happy to hurt people and kill people are the people that are aligned with the government and get government money through, you know, pharmaceuticals or SNAP programs or whatever. They basically get taxpayer supported incentives and income to poison people. But, you know, left to a true open market situation. Yeah. Who wants to run the risk of a bad chicken, a bad cow, but the big companies, they know that if they cheat or they're not careful or they're negligent, they can call their press conference when there's a recall and their hand gets caught with the, you know, hand in the cookie jar and they have a recall. They can call a press conference and say, we have complied with every government requirement and every food safety regulation. And basically they hide under the skirts of the government bureaucracy, and the whole country gives them a pass. Wow, these guys are really, you know, they're okay after all. It's
airplanes do that too, right? FAA regulations states that is the airline not wanting to stand up for their own safety policies.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It's I got to hide behind daddy, basically. That's what they're doing there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay, so I have one question here. It's back to the meat. Why are we so scared of meat, Joel? It's like much of the food poisoning examples that we see that really made people sick were from vegetable matter. And yet, so AJ wants to know, do you think that the future of the USDA CIS program is, well, I think he's asking if it'll go away, because he makes freeze-dried bone broth from grass-raised chickens from a farmer near him, who's raising them the way you teach people to.
Mm-hmm.
He turns that into bone broth, which is awesome, freeze-dries it, and he would love to be able to mail it out of his state, but he can't because of that.
Right, right, right. Well, yeah, you're exactly right, Nicole. I think it's something like 95% or more of all foodborne bacterial outbreaks, foodborne, you know, pathogenicity, is leafy greens. The reason it's leafy greens is because there's no kill step. I don't want to get too far into the culinary weeds here, but a kill step is where it either gets so hot or so cold or so dry that you know, microbes die, pathogens die. And that happens in cooking, it happens in freezing, but leafy greens don't have that kill step. They're cool, damp, and fresh. And all three of those elements are an entree for bacterial microbial contamination. And so, yeah, you're exactly right. The number of people who've been hurt by meat are a minuscule, I mean, they are just a tiny fraction, 5% maybe, of the people that are hurt from foodborne bacteria, you know, leafy greens. So, you know, the one thing to not buy out of the supermarket is leafy greens. I mean, that's the highest risk thing you can buy out of a supermarket. Lowest risk thing is meat. So we've got it completely, skewed, and that's where we are. I certainly don't see this changing anytime soon. I mean, it's one of the problems with, you know, regulatory creep is that it just is like a cancer, you know, it just keeps growing and keeps, you know, finding new things to control. And that's just the way it is.
Okay, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the family and Polyface, because what you've built there is an example of what many parents dream of, where it becomes a multi-generational farm where you can pass on best practices and build from there. And I know that you took your parents' methods, built on them to scale, to make profit at Polyface, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And as part of that, somehow your children are now involved and they now have children. So how did you set that foundation?
Yeah. So I'm a big believer in childhood entrepreneurism. And so there's two parts of this. One is the parents have to be willing to back off and delegate early on to create a track record for the next generation so that kids, so that as the parents age, they're not concerned that the kids are going to, you know, sink the ship. the problem is parents tend to be so slow at delegating that they, by the time it needs to be done, the next generation hasn't developed enough of a track record for the parents to be comfortable in the transition. And so then you have this tension. The parents won't let the kids do anything because they're afraid they're going to, you know, sink the ship. And the kids say, well, mom and dad won't let me do anything because they don't trust me. And you have this complete breakdown. So you have that element. And in our family, you know, dad couldn't get out of the way fast enough. When I expressed interest and aptitude, you know, to the farm, he got, you know, gave it over as early as he possibly could. And fortunately, then when he passed away very, very young. He was only 66. I was 31. And that seems really, really young to me now. But there was no blip, no bobble, no nothing. It was just smooth right along. And as you know, we've pretty much given over all day-to-day operations to Daniel. Daniel now runs everything, and I'm the least important person here now. I show up, but I'm from a day-to-day operation, I'm the least important. So that's one thing, the whole delegation, you know, transfer. The second part is to encourage childhood businesses. And I think there's a sweet spot between about 8 and 11 that this has to happen. So up until 8, lots of times, a child would prefer 2 quarters to a dollar. But something happens somewhere between 7 and 8 that they start realizing, I think I'd rather have the dollar than 2 quarters. And you know, in other words, you've got to have enough understanding of money and enough understanding of profit loss, you know, adding and subtracting, things like that, to be able to actually think through, you know, business decisions. And that comes at about 8. Well, why 11 on the other end? Well, because on the other end, once you go past about 11, then children start getting really interested in what other people think. And as soon as you start getting there, then you're not as, you know, as a prone to market yourself, market a product that you've done, you know, any of this sort of thing. You know, my favorite story on this was our little granddaughter, Lauren. She's about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years old. We had a chicken pickup day at the farm, so she knew there were going to be a lot of customers here. And so, you know, the farm store has people all in it. And she disappears, which is, you know, that's fine. She, you know, she can go wherever she wants to. And she comes back about 20 minutes later. She's carrying this little bouquet of wildflowers, and she looks around. You know, she's about five or six. She's looking up at the adults around. She finally spies this one man standing there, and she goes up and she says, hi, I'm Lauren Salatin, and I picked this bouquet of wildflowers, and I'm sure your wife would really love some flowers today, and I'm selling them for $1. And of course, you know, by this time we're all, you know, all of our eyes are on her, you know, what she's been doing. And what was really hilarious was that she didn't even wait for an answer. She already had plan B, you know, without even waiting for him to respond. You know, she says, but, you know, if you don't have a wife, I'm sure you know a lady who would love to have some, a bouquet of flowers. And here's the point, Nicole, at 12, she never would have done that. Only when you're young and innocent and, you know, everybody's telling you you're cute and all that, that's when you have the, whatever, the, you know, the savvy and the freedom, the mental freedom to be able to engage in that. So I think this 8 to 12 is really a magic time for kids. And you know, I do a lot of homeschool conventions, and it amazes me how many different things an 8 to 11 year old can do for as an entrepreneur. I mean, I got my first chickens when I was 10. Our kids, Daniel, started his rabbits when he was 8. Rachel started her baking business when she was, I don't know, about 7 or 8. All of our grandkids, one had ducks, one had lambs, one had exotic chickens. They all started their businesses between 8 and 11. And so I just think that, that whether you're on a farm or not, if you're not on a farm, you know, I mean, everything from obviously the old classic was, you know, lawn mowing, you know, you got dog sitting, you've got, you know, sitting with an older person. I mean, there are all sorts of things that, I mean, the classic lemonade stand, right? But there's all these things. And I think too often, especially now, as parents, we're losing we've lost our kids to TikTok and video games, and we're losing this entrepreneurial, whatever, you know, encouragement bent to develop that to where the kids, to where the kids enter adulthood with real self-worth because they have real skill. They know how to do things. They know who they are because they've done things. You don't learn who you are by playing video games. You learn who you are by successfully accomplishing meaningful tasks.
And you don't have time to do that if you're staring at your phone.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as a person who has one like literally right next to her here, I've become increasingly keenly aware of this in the last couple of years, that it's very easy for me when I am mentally exhausted to just stare at it. Which is not getting it, rather than, I don't know, go for a walk and have a cup of tea, which might help with that mental exhaustion. That just keeps it going because you're going from one thing to the next to the next.
Yeah. Well, you know me. You know me. I'm still.
I'm getting there, Joel. I'm like, maybe it's time to have a flip phone. Also, if you have that number, guys, he doesn't actually answer it unless you're picking him up at the airport. So you may have a phone, but it's not a real one. Cell phone. Yeah.
That's right. Well, it doesn't work in our house. You know, we have this old 1790 American chestnut log cabin. The walls are like 18 inches thick, and nothing comes through the walls. So at least we know we're not getting the EMFs, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. So do you see in your grandchildren, do you think you know who might take over the farm next, or is it too early to tell? You don't have to say who it is.
Yeah, too early to tell. Don't have any idea. And you know what? If one of them doesn't, that's okay, because we've got enough of a team now, you know, young people that I think sometimes you can get cultish on your family where you can feel like, well, and your kids then can feel, you know, pressured. Well, you know, if I don't do this, then they're not going to love me, you know, kind of thing. And that's not good either. So, you know, you've got to keep the options open.
Yeah. Okay. So we're coming up on an hour, and this is a good time for me to ask you, what would you share with people who are working hard to get their homesteads ready. They're back where your parents were, basically, to start the journey to set themselves up for success.
Yeah, well, there's a couple things. You know, one is to not try to do it all at once. I see so many people. So what you do is you read all these articles and you build all these castles in your head, you know, and I want it all today. I want it all, you know, tomorrow. And you get spread too thin. The next thing you know, the cows are out and the, you know, tomatoes are weedy and all this stuff kind of crumbles in on you. So I think it's really critical to appreciate the, you know, the incrementalism and the patient, you know, the patient development of whatever you're going to do and realize that you can't learn. You can't be, I don't want to say learning. You can't start too many things at once, or you just won't get much done well. That's one element. The other element is to remember that good enough is perfect. I know you saw that really cute shed in Guns N' Roses or whatever the magazine is. Or Southern Living, but yours doesn't have to look like that. All it's got to be is functional, function over form. And people get all, you know, distraught about, well, what's it going to look like? What's it going to look like? No, all it has to do is work. If it works, that's one of the things. I mean, you've been to our place. You know, when you look at our buildings, you can definitely tell the ones that I built and the ones that Daniel built, because he's a lot better builder than I am. But, you know, I've never had a cow say, oh, I'm not going to go in that barn because it's not exactly, you know, like the picture in the barn building, you know, photo. They really don't care. And in fact, half the world doesn't live in buildings, you know, better than this. And so get over yourself, get over the form of it and get on with the function of it. You can always tweak it, refine it, remodel it, you know, pretty it up, put paint on it. Whatever later, but right now the key is to, you know, start with one piece at a time, and then, you know, do the pieces in a way that's within your capability, your capacity, and so that you're moving, and the movement creates, you know, the next need for the next move.
And that's much more insightful than y'all realize, to start with function over form, because when you list the functions that you want something to do, it will change the design of what you're doing from the standard Home Depot recommended. Like my kitchen, people come into my kitchen, they're like, I love your kitchen. It's made out of plywood, restaurant tables, because I wanted it to be functional for what we do here, which is different than an off the shelf option. And two, I wanted, it's like you're don't put a permanent fence in till a temporary one's been there for 2 years. That's how my kitchen is right now, because that's the center of what I do. It's very easy to change right now. I have $80 in plywood for a counter, and so it doesn't hurt my heart to take out this expensive granite thing if I decide the sink needs to be smaller, which I did decide. When I do my next wave. So that function thing also is your way of getting your basic form and function right before you lock it all cute. And then your heart hurts when you have to take a chainsaw to your cute chicken coop or whatever.
Yeah. Because you realized that you didn't make it so that it would handle, you know, 24-inch deep bedding. You know, once you realize about the compost and the carbonaceous diaper and all that stuff. So yeah, be a light, you know, be light-handed in the stuff that you're doing. You know, a lot of things, I mean, you know, side-by-sides, you know, you're supposed to have a $20,000 side-by-side, you know, if you're a respectable, well, mine is a $3,700, 2000 model, Jeep Cherokee. And you know, there were millions of them made, easy to work on, and it's only $3,700. And, you know, if it goes down in a couple of years, well, I'm just out a little bit. These four wheelers and stuff, you know, they're expensive. They're recreational vehicles, or, you know, made that way, so they carry a recreational price. And And so there's a lot of things that you can do. Instead of buying a tractor, have a neighbor over that has the kind of tractor you would like and have them over for dinner, build a relationship with them. And maybe you can help the neighbor build fence and he can come down and donate a few days of his tractor with you. You don't have to buy one at all. And all it's cost you is a little bit of time and friendship. A lot of farmers are lonelier than they've ever been in their life because their kids are gone. They're older now and they're lonely. And if you show a little bit of love and friendship to somebody, you'd be surprised what you might end up being able to enjoy from both the expertise and the equipment of a neighbor.
That's 100% true. Well, Joel, I want to thank you for giving us time today. Guys, check out The Lunatic Farmer and Polyface Farms. If you're having trouble finding grass-fed meat, I know you can order it online and ship it straight to your house. I haven't done it yet, but I'm about to start a series where I do order some meat from Joel to tell you how much it actually costs to cook with that quote-unquote expensive meat, because I figured out once you use the practice of cooking and folding things forward to different meals and the leftovers, it's actually less than using the crap from the grocery store. So there's no reason to get stuck in that trap. And if you want to see him in person, there's Exit and Build Land Summit's coming up, as well as he will be at Midwest Preparedness Project, I think, next week, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
In Kansas.
Next week. That's coming right up.
Awesome. Any parting words before we say goodbye?
The whole idea here is take all the frustration and anxiety that you have about our dysfunctional system and invert it to be a positive, proactive change so that when the world becomes hopeless and helpless, we can offer hope and help.
Thank you so much for being on today, Joel.
Thank you, Nicole.
Yep. If you like the show and want to support the work I'm doing here, you can do it in two ways. One, get your coffee at hollerroast.com. And two, today is a different call to action. Get your food right so you get your nutrition right, so you get your health right, so that you can build a life without limits. Make it a great week.